You made it to Friday. Thanks for joining Wintrust Business Lunch. G here. Lots of good info today. Is working from home or remotely more efficient? Maybe you're a manager wondering about weighing costs of having employees work part-time or full-time away from the office. Or maybe you're an employee trying to convince your boss that it's a good idea. So that's coming up in the show. Also, if you're still hoping to maybe make some money in this new legal pot business that's happening all over the state, stay tuned as well for that. That's coming up all in the Wintrust Business Lunch. Let's get started. You heard Orion and Steve mention the Labor Department's report just released. December's payroll and wage growth missed expectations, but it's not all bad news. And joining us is Bankrate.com Chief Financial Analyst Greg McBride. Hi, Greg.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about the report that was just released.
December job growth, we did see continued job growth, 145,000 new jobs in December. The unemployment rate remains at a 50-year low of 3.5%. That was the good news. There were some real weak spots, though. We did see that the quality of jobs was a lot different in December than what we had seen in previous months. Retailers, leisure, and hospitality constituted the lion's share of that job growth. As opposed to in past months, we've seen professional and business services and healthcare, higher-paying sectors leading the way. Also, the average hourly earnings on a year-over-year basis dipped below the 3% mark. It had been accelerating in recent months above the 3% mark. So that slower pace of growth in wages, not good news for households, particularly when it comes to spending power.
So more jobs were created, but doesn't necessarily translate to wage growth, as you just mentioned.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, normally as the labor market gets tighter, you tend to see wages go up at a faster pace. And then one of the confounding things about this economic expansion is that despite the 50-year low in unemployment, we're just not seeing that wage growth accelerate like we would have or have like we have in previous expansions.
And why is that, do you think?
That's everybody's kind of trying to pinpoint what reason it is. And, the fact is, there's probably a variety of different factors. Globalization, I think, is one. Technology has also reduced costs a lot, but that also is keeping a lid on wages. We've got a slow growth economy. So if the top line is growing at a pretty slow pace, it limits the ability to pass along higher wages to employees. So that's just a few of the factors that come into play. There are undoubtedly more as well.
Talking to Bankrate.com's Chief Financial Analyst Greg McBride, you said that the numbers that were just released by the Labor Department's report suggest that manufacturing jobs are still not doing that great.
No, still, manufacturing is the sector that's contracting. Still a lot of weakness there. Not surprising considering the length and extent of the trade dispute. Maybe we start to see a turnaround in that over the next few months. We get phase one of the deal with China signed. Maybe that starts to change the fortunes of the manufacturing sector. But for now, that's definitely the sector where we're seeing contraction in contrast to the remainder of the economy.
Are we recovering from the retail apocalypse that happened in 2019?
Well, for 1 month it would appear so, but I don't know about you, but every mall I drive by, there are stores that are closing and they continue to have a more difficult time. So, when we look at the fact that there were 41,000 new retail jobs added in December, including 33,000 in clothing stores, it makes me question how sustainable that is.
So this is some good news and some it didn't reach expectations. What's your take on it all?
Well, I think that's a fair way of summing it up. I mean, it was, it's kind of a middle-of-the-road jobs report. On the one hand, we saw job growth. The fact that it's coming at a slower pace, it isn't necessarily alarming considering where we are. The concerning factor to me, though, was the quality of the new jobs that were being created and the fact that we saw a deceleration in average hourly earnings. To me, those are the two things that we need to sit up and pay attention to.
And what's your take, Greg, on recession? You think it's farther away than people predicted, and you're staying positive?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think this report underscores that. Again, we continue to see creation of jobs, job growth. We see earnings going up, maybe not as fast as we'd like, but we do see household earnings going up. All of those are positive indicators, indicative of an economic expansion that's continuing. You don't look at this and see signs that the economic expansion is coming to an end or that recession is on our doorstep. Every indication is that that's still down the road. We've got this virtuous cycle of people working, people making more money, and people spending money. Consumer spending is the pillar that's on which the economy rests. So as long as that virtuous cycle stays intact, I think the economic expansion can continue, albeit at a modest pace.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. This is Bankrate.com Chief Financial Analyst Greg McBride. Can't wait to have you back on the show. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
So is it too late for you to get in on this legalized weed business in Illinois? To talk about it with us is Avis Bulboyan. He's the CEO of Siva Enterprises, which is a full-service cannabis business and development firm. Hi, Avis.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. So right off the bat, so all of the licenses have been distributed at this point. Is it too late for folks to get in on the legal weed business here in the state?
Actually, no. A lot of this stuff is just getting started. The licenses have not all been issued. The applications were accepted about 2 weeks ago. They're still being evaluated. Those results come out middle of May for 75 retail licenses to open up dispensaries for adult use. A second round of licensing for cultivation, transportation, and manufacturing is going on right now. And the deadline for those to be submitted is 2 months. So this is all just getting started.
So you're talking about the additional 40 licenses for each for the craft growers and then also for...
infuser and transportation.
Yep, absolutely. So there's still a lot of room for people to get in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if it's not this round, if somebody is looking to get into it and they're just starting to see the opportunity, they may not make it for this round, but my suggestion would be to get started, expose yourself to the industry, try to get a job in the industry, because this thing, like I said, across the country, it's just starting up. It's just starting to build up traction. So if it's now, it's probably going to open up again in about another year, year and a half. So if you're looking to get into the industry, expose yourself to it as much as you can, learn about it as much as you can, and try to pick up a job within the industry.
And it sounds like there's a shortage of workers as well.
Huge. Big.
What do you account that for? I mean, what was the reason?
Well, it's just a function of the rollout. Until the licenses get issued, until these projects actually get implemented, once you get the license, the average company is going to have anywhere from 4 to 6 months to implement the project and open up their doors. That's your build out, that's your compliance stuff, and just being ready to service the customers. So a lot of the job opportunity is going to start building up sometime around the summertime. But whenever you have a new industry coming up, the industry is driven by its workers. So the more the industry gets rolled out in Illinois and across the country, the more job creation you'll start seeing.
So the governor and his administration were really touting this, the way they did this rollout and the way they were testing social equity measures for the recreational pot law. What would you say in terms of how we've done so far?
Compared to the other states, Illinois has done a really great job at it. It still has a lot that needs to be done. A lot of it because there really isn't a lot of precedent in how to do this in a way that's conducive for business operations. A lot of the states, a lot of the local municipalities are really trying it out, playing with different ideas, different concepts. Right now, the big major state that's done anything on the social equity side is California. But California, because it's a dual licensing process where it all starts off in local, you're starting to see a lot of local jurisdictions play with different concepts, which most of them are now working. Illinois is one of the first states that's really done a social equity program at the state level. So compared to the other jurisdictions, they've done a great job in providing the opportunity to immediate family members of individuals that were affected by the war on drugs. They've created an opportunity where it's not all about the equity, and you could qualify for social equity through your hiring practices and paying that with opportunity forward. But in the grand scheme of things, there's still a lot that needs to be done for it to be a functioning program.
So For people that applied for a license and they were able to boost their points based on the social equity measures, how many of them, percentage-wise, from your experience in other states, like you said in California, are able to actually partake and use a license and build a brick and mortar and actually make money?
Social equity or in general?
Social equity. How many of those? Because it takes a lot of money, right, to actually make this happen.
It does. See, a couple of years ago, when you were setting up a shop, because of the regulatory uncertainties, which still exist today, but it's a lot more so true for a couple of years ago, a lot of these companies weren't really investing too much money into their operations because they didn't know how long they were going to stay open. So you could set up a dispensary for anywhere from $50,000 to $150,000, which, relatively speaking, is not that much. These days, because of the brand concepts and a lot more focus on the consumer experience, retail experience, unless you're going into this with $500 to $1 million in retail build-out and expenses to just even start generating cash, you're probably not going to see the type of revenues that everyone expects you to see. Across the country, a lot of these companies, particularly on the retail side, they're affected by the federal tax code, which is 280E, which really impacts the retail side of the supply chain the most, which really minimizes your earning capacity. Now, when we talk about social equity businesses across the country, you probably don't have more than a handful, maybe two, three of them, and I doubt any one of them are even making any money just because, A, they just started out, they just implemented their projects. Those companies, you'll see them in California and some other states. Massachusetts just approved a social equity business. But in the grand scheme of things, nobody's really making money. One, they haven't implemented. Two, when they do implement, the deck is completely stacked against these companies.
So the state's going to conduct a study at a later date to examine any of the disparities in the cannabis rollout, especially in regards to the social equity elements and the applicants there. But as you mentioned, there were 700, more than 700 applicants for the 75 new shops. So you're saying that those licenses haven't been awarded yet. They're still going through all the applicants?
Yes. Those results will come out in the middle of May, May 15th.
Okay, so, and then 40 craft grower licenses, 40 infuser licenses, and then the number of transporter licenses is not capped. So what would be your recommendation for somebody who's listening who wants to get involved?
Well, first thing is forget about the fact that it's a cannabis business. This is no different than any other business. It's no different than any other industry. You happen to be dealing with a Schedule I drug at the federal level. You're dealing with inconsistent regulation from state to federal. But a lot of this stuff, it's really no different than any other industry. The most successful people in this space are the people that take what they do and they apply to this industry. Now, when we talk about the cannabis business, everyone is a lot more hyper-focused on license ownership. The license ownership does not, it's not all there is in the cannabis business. You've got all the traditional needs of traditional industries, marketing, payroll companies, staffing companies, legal, market, I mean, just across the board. So if you're not in a position to get in on the license ownership side, there are more than enough ways to get in on the ancillary services side, on the brand building side, where it doesn't have to be license ownership. So if you're looking at this, first of all, download the state regulations. The state regulations are your friend. Don't look at it as a whole document. Break it up into the sections. Break it up into chunks. And once you start breaking it up into chunks and it becomes a lot more digestible, the regulations generally tell you what's not allowed or they tell you what is allowed. If it's not addressed, generally it's acceptable. But don't be intimidated by it. Expose yourself to the industry. Attend some networking events. Attend some training events, employer events. Staffing companies are hosting a lot of these job fairs. So it really just comes down to exposing yourself to the industry and absorbing as much of it as you can. Take a lot of your personal experiences applied to the industry.
So, Avis, if someone is awarded a license and then they end up not being able to complete the funding and open up a brick-and-mortar store, what happens to that license?
Generally, most states have a certain window where you have to execute, whether it's 6 months, whether it's 12 months. Illinois hasn't really addressed that. Generally speaking, these licenses, once they are issued, they don't generally stay dormant. Companies, once it's issued, they are able to put together funding. If nothing else, if they're not able to execute, usually they'll flip them. They'll sell it to a secondhand operator or somebody that didn't make the first cut, but they have the capital to be able to acquire it. So you hardly ever see a license that gets surrendered because they weren't able to implement it.
Okay, so a lot of opportunities down the road. Thank you so much, Avis Bulbulyan, CEO of Siva Enterprises, which is a full-service cannabis business and development firm. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
G here with the Wintrust Business Lunch. Do you work from home? Do you wish you worked from home? Or are you a business owner that wonders whether it will really save you money or not? Joining us is Teresa Douglas. She is a remote work advocate and an author of a book as well about working remotely. Hi, Teresa.
Hi there.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So is working from home efficient or not?
Oh, it's so efficient. I think we only have to look outside our window to see what type of time savings you can have with the snow and the ice and everything that's going on. Workers just get more done. There's less distractions, fewer distractions, and you can put your head down and plow through your to-do list.
Do you advocate for working part-time remotely or full-time remotely?
I advocate for whatever makes sense for the business and for the people there. Obviously, all jobs are different. For some people, it makes sense to work from home full-time. For others, maybe a day or two a week is what really makes sense.
Can you give us some hard numbers or percentages on how many businesses are headed this way and or are already engaged in having employees work part-time or full-time remotely or from home?
Sure. According to Global Workplace Analytics, only about 7% of U.S. businesses make this available to their employees. Although, according to their numbers, at least 50% of the U.S. workforce holds a job that's compatible with remote work. So we're still in that infancy stage, although there's been a lot of growth. It's just the percentage of jobs is still small.
So you said 50% of businesses have compatibility with having employees work remotely for some of the time?
For some of the time, yes, according to Global Workplace Analytics.
So for a business owner that's listening or a manager, what are some of the positives for allowing your employees to do this?
Well, one of the biggest positives is if workers work from home 2 to 3 days a week, so not even full time, a business could save an average of $11,000 per employee per year, which is a not insignificant amount of money.
And you also don't have to provide, I'm assuming, a desk. You don't have to pay for the space to have the worker work from the office, including printers and computers and all of those things.
Yeah, so you're saving money that way. It also gives you the ability to be more agile. So if you're in a market and you wish to expand into another location, your employees that you have may be able to absorb that. For example, in my job, I live in Vancouver, Canada, and I manage people in California and Texas. So there's a lot of agility that a business can have to lower that overhead.
But isn't it a challenge to manage people remotely?
Well, I will answer that two ways. One, it's a challenge to manage people anywhere. People are messy. they get sick. They have workplace issues you have to deal with. There is an added layer with the technology, but it's a skill, so it's not a gift. It's something everybody can learn. You can learn to talk to people on a video call. Most of us are already comfortable emailing as just part of our everyday work. So there is a bit of a learning curve, but it's not something that's insurmountable.
I would imagine from the management standpoint, the concerns would revolve around accountability and efficiency.
Absolutely. There's that sense that if you can't see somebody, then they have to be slacking. Because as managers, we're responsible for what other people do. But really, if somebody's in an office and they're sitting in front of their computer, they could also be slacking. They could be on Facebook and not working on their project. But the benefit to working remotely is that you're laser focused on those outcomes. Is your person producing quality work? And if they are and they're doing it on time, desks, and they're working even though you can't see them.
We're talking to Teresa Douglas, co-author of Working Remotely, Secrets to Success for Employees on Distributed Teams. Is that the new term, distributed teams?
There are a lot of terms out there. It used to be that we said telework, and then remote came into vogue, distributed. This is a complex place where you may have some or all of your team working in different locations, but it all means people that are in different locations, some of whom may be working from home.
And it doesn't matter what size of company that you're running, whether it's a small business versus a Fortune 500 company?
That's right. There are many small businesses that started out remote first. I think of Buffer. I think of Zapier. So a lot of the technology companies. But there are also smaller mom-and-pop companies, event companies, who all work from home, and they still get their work done.
What are some of the tips, let's say you are an employee that's now working remotely, for successfully working remotely so that you can continue, that your boss continues to let you do this?
So a couple of things. Remote employees have to be spectacular communicators. So my boss should never wonder what it is that I'm doing with my day. My boss should already know that. So I have, as an example, my own set hours that I keep. I log in, I talk to my boss, I let him know what I've been doing, I let him know what I've done. And keeping that communication open, communicating with your boss, communicating with your colleagues, that's the grease that keeps business running no matter what, but especially true in a remote workforce.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Teresa Douglas, she's a remote work advocate. She's also the co-author of Working Remotely, Secrets to Success for Employees on Distributed Teams. Where can people find your book?
You can find it anywhere books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and on the internet at large.
Well, thanks so much, Teresa.
Thank you.
Just mentioned in the Wintrust Business Minute were the rumors about Grubhub exploring options, including even a sale. To set the story straight, we have Cranes reporter John Pletz. Hi, John.
Hey, how are you?
Fantastic. Thanks for joining us. So give us the scoop. What's going on with Grubhub?
Well, Grubhub says it's not for sale, or at least it's not currently running a process to sell itself. So they came out last night. It's an unusual step to kind of squash those rumors.
Initially, this was reported by the Wall Street Journal on Wednesday that they were going to be exploring options. So do you believe them that they're not going to?
Well, you got to take them at their word. It's a very unusual step for a company to flatly say, no, we're not considering a sale. These rumors happen from time to time. It's not unusual. And normally companies don't step in one way or the other, and, you know, sooner or later either a deal happens or a deal doesn't. This is a pretty unusual case of them saying, hey, we're not running a sale. And the reason that matters is a couple of months ago when Grubhub sort of indicated to Wall Street that, hey, we're going to be in for a long, grinding, tough competition, you know, price war in the food delivery space. And, you know, it's going to take down profits a bit, but we're in it for the long haul. You know, the stock really took a hit, and an analyst took the really unusual step of publicly calling out the board of directors and saying, this doesn't sound so good to me. I think you should consider some options, including maybe a merger. And so that's what had everybody sort of on high alert that, you know, the stock is down roughly, you know, two-thirds from where it was a little over a year ago. It was nearly $150 a share. So take all those things together. That's what had everybody paying very close attention to Grubhub.
It's also a Chicago-based company as well, and they say that they're committed to just an organic growth strategy.
Yeah, I think what they're talking about there is Grubhub has done a lot of acquisitions over the years, really successfully, by the way. Before they went public, they merged with a competitor, Seamless, in New York. When they needed to get into the delivery space, they did several acquisitions to do that. When they needed to expand beyond Chicago and New York, they did some strategic acquisitions. So Grubhub has done a lot of buying in the past. And I think what they're signaling is they think they've got a lot of room to grow just by increasing the business they've got.
Okay. So this is good for the stockholders?
We'll see. I mean, they still need to get that stock price moving, and they need to figure out a way to do it. You have an industry that has a lot of competition, and competition generally puts pressure on prices and profits. That's what's happening. You know, Grubhub is a little bit unique. Up until Uber Eats, they were the only company in this space that had gone public. So they have real revenue, real customers, real profits. A lot of the competitors that are causing them and everybody else heartburn are venture-funded, you know, backed by investors who are willing to lose money. You know, none of the other companies, it appears at least at this stage, are profitable. And that's where, you know, that's where the tension is.
Speaking with Crain's reporter John Pletz about Grubhub, of course, it's the online ordering and restaurant delivery company that's locally based and putting to rest rumors that Grubhub is considering selling or looking at other alternatives as well. Let's talk a bit about legalized pot sales in Illinois. This is something that you've been covering since the very beginning.
Yes. Yeah, I also, in addition to Grubhub, I also cover weed. Yeah.
I know, and you do it very well. So what's your assessment been so far? It's been, it's been over a week and a half, maybe,
just
right?
Over a week, yeah, just over a week. Yeah. New Year's Day was the beginning. I think it's gone pretty well. I think it's gone about as both people in the industry and, you know, people with the state had expected. A lot of demand, long lines, not enough supply. And the belief is that, you know, eventually that will sort itself out. It may take a while, but so far, so good.
I think some folks were expecting that supplies would be short, but were you surprised at just how many stores had to close?
No. We had written maybe a week or so before sales launched that they were going to be short, and they were going to be short for a while. And here's why. Because it's an industry that has basically gone legal state by state, you can't import product from outside. And the state of Illinois, passed this law at the end of June is when the governor signed it, and they wanted to be open by January 1. And that's just incredibly difficult. That's, you know, that is an incredibly ambitious schedule. And when you consider it takes roughly, you know, 90 days to grow the product, that doesn't leave you a lot of wiggle room. And not to mention just expanding the grow facilities is something that, you know, a number of the companies had expansion plans already on the books, but they're just, you know, you can't staff up or, crank up production that quickly. You've got a lot more capacity that's going to come online here in the next few months, but it could very easily be middle of the year, end of the year, before you really get supply sort of where everybody, you know, where it needs to be, so you don't have really long lines all over the place.
So not surprising to you either, along the same thought lines about not having enough workers.
The worker thing is a little surprising. I mean, this has happened in other places, but yeah, that's another bottleneck. And that is, you know, you can't change the biology of how fast you can grow the plants. You probably can change how quickly you can get employees badged. You know, the marijuana industry is something that the states regulate very heavily. Security checks for employees are pretty stringent by design. This was one of those problems that I think was foreseeable. And, you know, it's just another victim of having a really, really short window from the time that law got passed to the time they wanted to be up and running.
In terms of the social equity elements, in terms of the granting licenses, I know it's early, but do you feel as though it's been making a difference?
Well, you know, this is about determining who gets into the business, and right now this is an industry that is not at all diverse. So the efforts of, you know, a big piece of the legislation legalizing marijuana was to get more people, more minority owners into the business. So you've got a lot of people who see the opportunity. So the number of applications was really strong. The number of people seeking social equity status, meaning that if you're coming from either a neighborhood that really got impacted by the war on drugs, or people who had past criminal records related to marijuana possession. That's the way that you get social equity status. Most of the applicants are seeking that status. What will be telling is who gets the licenses. So 75 new licenses get awarded in May, and that's really when you're going to see, did they move the needle? Did they get, a more inclusive industry?
And your recent story was about how you can still get into the weed business, and you said that there are more licenses in terms of small craft growers and...
Right. The first round of licenses is for dispensaries, for retail shops, and that's sort of what everybody was focused on. But there are a number of other ways to get into the business. One is craft growers, which means small growers can get into the business, as well as transporters or people making product with, edibles, that sort of thing. And this is something that, Toy Hutchison, who oversees the marijuana program for the state, has really focused on. And said, this may be, if you're looking for ways
to get in,
we get new faces into this business, these are maybe some of the best ways. Because getting a dispensary open or getting into the cultivation business, at scale, it requires millions of dollars. And that's not really accessible. And these opportunities will probably get more individuals, more mom and pop sort of operators into the business, and those are going to be really worth watching. So those applications are just coming out now. They'll start awarding licenses later in the year. I think the first ones were awarded in July. So in addition to the dispensary licenses, which are going to get issued, those are really worth watching. And you want to see, okay, you've got this huge opportunity. It's going to be a $2 billion industry. Who are they going to share the wealth? Who gets in?
Well, as always, thank you, John Pletz, for all your info on Grubhub and always being on Pot Watch. You're doing a great job. Talk to you soon.
All right. Take care. Thanks, guys.
The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.